Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our midweek Bible class. Tonight we have our visiting speaker, Brother Riley Hollenby, and his title is The Spiritual Athlete, Playing on God's Team. We'll just have a reading, Revelation 7, verses 9 to 17. Thank you, Riley.
Well, thank you very much, Josh, and a very good evening to you all. Thanks for coming out tonight, and I'm excited to run through this topic of playing on God's team and this idea of the spiritual athlete. I was given free choice for any theme I wanted to run with on the general theme of Let Us Run that you are looking at this year. And I immediately jumped to this idea of the spiritual athlete, but it wasn't originally probably what we'll be looking at tonight. I think I can speak on behalf of many of you probably when I say the spiritual athlete, you probably immediately think of an individual athlete who might be running a race. We sometimes think of it as a marathon, not a sprint, things like that. But hopefully what we'll see tonight is that the analogy of a team player suits far better the concept of being a disciple on this race and letting us run together. And I came into this thinking or this train of thought while Ruby and I were looking through some reading plans to go through. And we were thinking, oh, well, let's do something on the spiritual athlete to sort of prepare ourselves for this. And it came up with this, we came up with this reading plan called Playing on God's Team. And it really ran through, it was actually an ex-NFL player or coach, I believe. And he was running through sort of a few things which he brought out from that team sport into being a disciple. And so I'm sorry if you don't have a great background in team sports. I'll try and explain it as best as I can. I've been fortunate enough to play quite a lot over my years. And so do have a fair bit of experience I can pull from this. And hopefully I'll be able to explain the amazing analogies. So that's the first question that we'll cover. Why are we thinking about team sports, not individual? Now, we'll get to the verses on the screen in a bit, but I was doing some research on, I guess collaboration as humans. And it came up with an article speaking to evolution, and obviously I'm not condoning the theory of evolution, but it did pose some interesting thoughts around the reason that humans have, in their eyes, evolved so far or so well, and obviously we consider it as the reason that we are a successful, I guess, successful is a loose term, but species, is collaboration. The article spoke to we've evolved to be able to collaborate and therefore we accelerated and whatnot. But I think our understanding of this is far more powerful. And that is that our designer and our creator actually gave us the ability to collaborate. And I think that's why the idea of let us run with endurance really fits in, is that God has given us so many tools of collaboration. We consider a lot of the work that Jesus actually completed in his life, and this was to bring us together, not to create individuals, but to create a group that could work and function together. Again, by nature, by God's creation, we are creatures of collaboration. And we see some examples of this, the encouragement that Paul gives people throughout a lot of his letters. And we see in Galatians 6, verse 2 there, carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. Therefore, encourage one another and build each other up, just as in fact you are doing. And finally, in Hebrews, let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds. And these all speak to this idea of we are stronger together, we can use each other. And that's why we are considering a team sport rather than an individual race. And one really big part of being in a team, and I guess what really defines a team is having, or a successful team at least, is you have this common goal that you want to strive to. If we think of a football team, a hockey team, for example, they start a season of their sport with this one goal in mind. Everyone rocks up to win a premiership. And it's the same for us. We all show up every day. We all show up for God or for each other because we are running towards this common goal. And if you just stay in Revelation 7 and we'll just have a look through our reading for tonight, because I think this is really where we see our common goal. Thank you for reading this, Josh. And we should be very familiar with this after Steve's lovely talk on this chapter on Sunday. But what we see here is in verse 9, people from every nation, from all tribes and languages, and they are in this one congregated spot. This is a joined group of people from many different backgrounds, all here for one common reason, and that is to give praise and honor to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And there's two really important parts here is when we think of our goal or our vision, we often think of a kingdom vision. And that's our end goal, is we all want to be together in God's kingdom. But also, so that's goal number one. That's the end goal. That's where we want to get to eventually. I think I can comfortably say that on behalf of everyone here, is that we want to be in God's kingdom. That is our goal individually and as an ecclesia. And the other bit is giving praise and honor to God. Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. That is goal number two, is that in our everyday life and in our ecclesial life, we want to give glory and honor to God and to bless him and to be thankful to him. So hopefully with that, we see this team really coming together. We are a group with a common goal. And so the next context question we need to ask is what makes a good team sports player? We're thinking of specifically here. And again, over many, many years of playing sport, these are the six most important things I came up with. Number one, being selfless. This means to be willing to work for your teammates, not wanting glory for yourself, but wanting to achieve a goal together. Number two, having respect for each other, for individuals in your team, having respect for your team's goals, and also having respect for coaches and leadership and acknowledging everyone's position in that team. Number three, resilience. I will speak to this concept of second efforts, but this is really the idea of never giving up, never letting a mistake determine what the outcome is, but instead getting back up, forgetting what's behind and pushing forwards. Again, commitment to a common goal, so keeping your eyes on the prize, if you like. We have accountability or discipline, and that's keeping both yourself accountable, that's the idea of discipline, and also accountability to other people, knowing that what you do has an effect on other people. And finally, communication. Everyone, I guess, in a team sport has a different view of the situation, and unless you communicate that to other people, it is completely useless. Now, obviously, we are not going to go through all of these, so I picked three. And unfortunately, even after doing this talk last week at Burnside, I still haven't highlighted the third one. But we will look at resilience in bold there, discipline also, and then knowing your position and respecting other people's roles. And so the rest of the night, we'll deep dive into these three key traits, I've called them. And each time we will do... we'll define the trait, we'll explore an example or a case study, and then I guess we'll apply this to us, why it's relevant to us, and hopefully be able to see some of the results of us displaying this trait. So, key trait number one is discipline. And probably the most relevant definition of discipline is that top one when you're thinking about yourself as an individual. And that is the ability to control yourself or other people, even in difficult situations. There's also this idea, which is relevant to us, our talk tonight. The discipline is training. So I guess if you are disciplining yourself, it's training that makes people more willing to obey or more able to control themselves. And it's often in the form of rules or punishments. And if these are broken, and punishments if you break the rules, or it's the behavior produced by this training. And that last bold bit speaks to the first definition. And so both of these are applicable to our spiritual athlete that we're considering tonight. Number one, as the bottom bit, training is essential to the to development of ourselves and also of discipline. And that's why we come to things like this tonight, because we understand that it is extremely important. And also, discipline being the ability to control yourself, obviously you'll be faced with many challenges in your walk. Many times the world, I guess the opposing team you could think of them as, is trying to draw you to them, and you're being disciplined, staying in our team structure and competing against that, I guess, temptation. And so I'm just going to read from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 to 11. Feel free to turn it up if you like. I'm reading it from the ESV. So Hebrews 12, starting at verse 5, reads, "And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." And so the reason I come to this chapter is not because I think God is necessarily directly disciplining us. Obviously, I don't personally think that, you know, God is going to strike me down if I, you know, make a mistake, for example, or am of ill discipline. But I think what it does allude to is that we should be grateful that God has given us discipline. This idea that we can discipline ourselves. And this might be through rules that, for example, God has put, or guidelines, I should say, that God has put in the word that we study, or in being with other people and being able to see their rules which have helped them to stick to their calling, to focus on that end goal. And so this section here is really talking to the fact that we should be grateful for this. Often discipline might be seen as something negative, of like, for example, in a game of in sport training, if you make a mistake at training, you might get asked to, you know, do 500 meter sprints or something, and it feels pretty horrible at the time, as is explained in here. But really, we should be grateful for the fact that God has given us these guidelines that we can discipline ourselves with. And so our case study for this idea of discipline is going to be Daniel and his three friends. So if you'll turn over, we won't go into too much detail over here, but if you want to follow along, we'll be mainly sitting in Daniel chapter 1 here. And so in Daniel chapter 1, the story begins with Daniel and his three friends and a whole bunch of other clever cookies from Israel or Judah, from Judah, have been taken from their home, brought to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. And we see in Daniel 1, verse 4, that these are, yes, that Daniel had aptitude for every kind of learning, it says. They were skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace. And then at the end of verse 4, we see that the purpose of this, exile to Babylon was to teach these people the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. And on the screen there, in the next, particularly in verse 6, we actually see that as part of this, integration into Babylonian society, Daniel and his three friends are given new names. Now, bit of a disclaimer, the definitions or the meanings of these names, particularly the Babylonian ones, are fairly highly debated. So don't take them for gospel. But hopefully what it's showing you is that what the Babylonians were really trying to do was not just make them, smart people for Babylon, but they were actually trying to completely change their identity. So we see over on the left here was the Hebrew name of Daniel and his three friends. So, for example, Daniel being judge of God, Hananiah, Yah has favored, or God has favored, Mishael, who is like God, and Azariah, Yah has helped. And so we see these are all, paying homage to God as our the center of their life, as their team, of Judah, if you like to think of it that way, trying to serve God. And the Chaldean or the Babylonian name that they're getting changed to is all about the Babylonian way of life of, serving gods who will benefit you is, the way they thought of it. We're going to serve these people because if I do that, that's going to benefit me. So I guess it's removing these people from a team culture where they're trying to serve their God because he's done for them. And instead they're being turned into individuals who are trying to serve gods, which will benefit them. That's, the whole the principle that serving these idols had. That's actually in verse 7, the name changes. And really what's happening here is they are being changed from, a team to individuals. And if we compare this to, our situation today, we think, as we've discussed to begin with, we want to work as a team, we want to serve our God and ultimately be in that kingdom at the end of it. And what the world is telling you is that you are, the most important person. You should serve yourself, you should better yourself. It is all about you. So that's a bit of context. Now, as we continue our story in Daniel 1, we see a pretty defiant Daniel in verse 8. And this is specifically in regards to the king's food, but I think it's a pretty good symbol for just saying separate from this Babylonian culture and remaining true to their identity in God's team. We see in verse 8, it says, "But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank." And I think the language there is, as I said, fairly defiant. It says Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself. And as we go through the story of Daniel, I guess we're not specifically told of how Daniel trained in his godliness, but we do clearly see discipline throughout his life. Again, in this example, in verse 8, we see discipline that he is resolving to remain separate from the Babylonians. And in Daniel chapter 2, you don't need to follow along, but if you'd like to, it's in verse 17 and 18 that Daniel has just been posed with Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and his immediate response isn't to go like, oh, woe is me, how am I going to solve this problem? How am I going to determine this dream? Instead, he goes and seeks mercy from the God of heaven with his three friends. Again, that's discipline, to stick to his process, to trust that God and God, the people that God has given him, will be able to solve it better than he as an individual. Even though he's been trained and told he's so clever, he is still trusting in God. And then after he's revealed the dream to Nebuchadnezzar, he doesn't take, again, he's disciplined. He does not take the credit for himself, but he gives glory to God. There is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. That's in verse 28. And there's a few other examples throughout Daniel's life. But what we do see is in Daniel chapter 6 and verse 10, it says here, again, different context, but pretty much bad things happened again. They're not allowed to worship any other god other than the gods of Nebuchadnezzar. And it says in verse 10, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open towards Jerusalem. And again, doesn't try and solve this on his own, but he got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he had done previously. And obviously the key thing here is two key things. Number one, as he had done previously, he remained disciplined in the way he trained himself, that three times a day he prayed to God. He went to a specific place and he gave time to bettering himself by talking to God. And if we think of that in, I guess, a team sport, we think of, you know, you might go to training twice a week. And in our life, that's all very different for each of us. But some of us might pray, you know, at a certain time each day to give dedicated time to God. Or we might read every day. Or we might, try and do an act of service to grow closer to God. Our discipline might look different for each of us. But the other important thing is that if we go back to our definition, even in difficult situations, and we think of all the times that Daniel and his three friends were faced with really life or death, and they every single time chose to stick to to what they knew was right, to their team goal of serving God. And the key here is that Babylon, again, are trying to make individuals, but Daniel and his three friends were disciplined, trusted their previous training, stuck to their previous training, and I guess the results are fairly clear throughout the story. Number one, they remain alive because they trusted in God, and number two, they're quite successful in their lives. That slide. Also, we consider Christ, who I guess we could consider as our captain, as our leader, someone who has gone before us, who's set an example. If we think of a captain on a sports team, we think of someone who's set an example, who's been there, who's done that. So I'm going to try and bring us back to Christ for all three traits. We think of his early life, where in Luke 2, verse 41 to 52, it's the story about they couldn't find Jesus because he was being dedicated and disciplined to training in his father's house. And we see this this training, this discipline, pays off, that when he's tempted, he has ammunition, if you like, to rebut the temptations that he faced. And we see that each time he stuck to his training, to what he knew was right. He was disciplined in his interactions with other people. We think of times where he stopped and he considered his answer before, before answering whatever questions people had or whatever problems people posed to him. And the results of all of this for him was he did run his race. He made it to the end of his goal. He completed the task that God had set before him. And now he sits immortal. So what does discipline look like for us? How can we be disciplined or dedicated to our training? And I came up with four key things here again. If we think of a high-performance athlete, these are all very important characteristics. Number one, diet. What are we, I guess, taking in? What are we ingesting? If we think of literally a good example being Daniel, he chose not to actually eat the king's food because it was a symbol to him of, you know, this completely opposite ideology of the Babylonians. So for us, what are we ingesting? Are we taking in from the world or are we taking in from God? Consistency. Again, Daniel prayed three times daily. A high-performance athlete might train four or five times a week. It's about consistency, being disciplined and sticking to routine. Choosing situation or discipline-specific exercises. And this is probably different for everyone, and so I'm not going to give any specific exercises. But I think Phil Shaw gave us some really good ones at the start of the year as an example of different things that we might be able to do. So reading or praying, discussing with other people, writing, singing, all of these different things, whatever works for you, repeat that discipline-specific exercise. And finally, taking time to reflect, to give yourself feedback, to give feedback to others, and also to receive feedback from others. Don't be disheartened if you feel like you need to discipline yourself, because again, it's a gift that we have from Hebrews, that God has given us this gift that we can be disciplined and aim to be, strive to be better people. And we mentioned this idea of accountability earlier. And one of the great things about being in a team, in a sporting context, as well as in an ecclesial context, is that you have other people to keep you accountable. If you aren't being disciplined, if you aren't seeing where you're going wrong, for example, we have other people who we can trust to go, hey, pull yourself together, mate. Or like, we can do that to other people. We're not in this journey alone. We are not individuals being individuals, but we are individuals in a team that we can help each other. And my final point being that be disciplined because you don't know who is watching. That's both internally and externally. We don't know who is being influenced by our actions, so be disciplined. Our second key trait is resilience. And we see that resilience is defined as the ability to be happy, successful, etc. Again, after something difficult or bad has happened. I'd like to point out I didn't put etc. in there. That was the dictionary, interestingly. That wasn't me being lazy. And when I think of resilience in a sporting context specifically, I immediately think of a mantra that was very much drilled into me from a young age, both from coaches and from very passionate parents. And that is second efforts. And this is, again, a whole idea of putting a mistake behind you. If it's in a, you know, football context again, if you miss a goal, there's no point in sulking about it. What you can change, you can't change that you've missed the goal, but what you can change is what happens next. Win the ball back. Do something for your team. And it's funny. I don't know if anyone else thinks this but when you're watching a game of football, for example, and you think, oh, why is the person who just missed the goal shouting at his other teammates to move here and there and everywhere? But that's actually a really good thing. That's a second effort. It's putting what you've done wrong behind you and just looking forward at what you can change, at what you can affect. And I think resilience is essential to a team athlete, but more importantly to a spiritual athlete, because we are far from perfect. Mistakes will happen and we will mess up. We'll feel useless or however you feel, but you can't change that. What you can change is what you do next. And our character study for resilience is Peter. Now, I apologize for a bit of an eyesore of a table. We won't go through each one of those individually, but they're just some examples where I found that Peter stuck his neck out, if you like, or he took action, and he was often wrong. He often made mistakes. He often required correction. And we'll see that that is not a bad thing. We will touch on a few of these. And so if we think of Matthew 14, verse 28, we see that Peter goes out to try and join Jesus walking on the water, and ultimately he sinks in front of everyone. He is told, "Oh, you of little faith." Immediately after this, in Matthew 16, verse 22, Jesus is talking to the disciples about the fact that he will die, that he will, he will have to sacrifice himself for everyone else. And Jesus actually, he literally calls Peter his adversary or Satan. And if, I guess, we think of a more relatable concept, it's kind of like in a team sport, copping a spray from a coach, like a halftime rev up. It's like what are you doing? Pull your head in, kind of thing. And it's in front of everyone. Again, I just think of how little I would feel after that. And I just disclaimer, I'm not obviously questioning why these things happen. These are just the facts. Skipping ahead in Matthew 26 and verse 35, we see another example where Peter claims that he will never disown Jesus even to the point of death. And then further on in that chapter, we obviously know that Peter denies Christ three times. And in verse 75, I'll just read that. Matthew chapter 26 and verse 75. We read, "And Peter remembered the saying of Jesus, 'Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times.' And he went out and wept bitterly." And I think what we are, what we do see here is, I guess, for a man of such, I guess, stubbornness as Peter to be weeping bitterly, this must be a pretty low point in his life. Again, there's a bunch of things which have led up to this point where, Peter keeps on getting up. He keeps on putting himself out there and he keeps on making mistakes. And finally, it seems to have broken him. I guess to play more into this, making it relatable, if you just imagine one of your closest friends, because that is what Jesus was to Peter, dying right after you had just effectively betrayed them in your eyes. That's how Peter's feeling right now. But we are talking to the topic of resilience, and that is exactly what Peter was. In John 20, verse 2 to 6, as soon as he hears about Jesus, just an inkling that Jesus might be alive, he runs to find Jesus' empty tomb. In John chapter 21, verse 7, as soon as he notices that it's Jesus standing on the shore, he jumps off the boat to meet him. He can't wait to get to him. And we, after all of this, after, constantly sticking his hand up to answer things, constantly being wrong, we hear about his profound impact on the early ecclesias. Peter's name, I believe, translates pretty much to rock, and that is really what he was. Peter was the rock which Jesus could build his early ecclesia on, and that's why he spent so much time with him. I think I did have it on. Oh, I didn't have it up on the slide, sorry, but there's this other definition of resilience, which it's more about, I guess, an item's resilience or a material's resilience, where its ability to return to its original shape after being, squashed, porn, like trying to tear it apart, etc., etc. And there's very few things like a rock that, you know, you can't push it and it just remains the same. And so when we think of Peter, the rock of the early ecclesias, there's no better example of resilience. After all of the times that he felt like he let himself, the disciples, and even Jesus down, we see in Acts chapter 2, after on the day of Pentecost, it's Peter that stands up first and addresses everyone in that room, all the apostles and all the fellow disciples. It's not anyone else. It's Peter who takes action. In Acts chapter 3, he heals a man and then he addresses the crowd. He's the one that again stands up and takes action. In Acts chapter 4, it goes before the Sanhedrin. There's few people who I imagine would enjoy like correcting you or, you know, telling you that you're wrong than people in the Sanhedrin. But he, again, stands up for his beliefs. He goes to prison for Jesus, and eventually he dies as Jesus predicted. He did actually stand up for Jesus to the point of death in the end. He said back in Matthew 26, verse 35, that he would not deny Christ even to death. And even after denying Christ three times, he gets back up and he sticks to this promise, to the point of death. So why is resilience important to a spiritual athlete in a team or an individual context? And I think the most important thing that we see throughout Peter's life is that you don't need resilience if you're not taking action. If you aren't taking action, you won't make mistakes and you won't need to bounce back from them. But that seems like a pretty useless and, I guess, depressing life in a way. That if you just want to exist because you're too scared of taking action for your team or for the cause that you have committed to, then you don't need resilience. But I hope that we all here are wanting to take action in any little way that is. And we will make mistakes. Peter needed resilience, as do we, because he so often made the effort. He so often took action. And again, if we think of this in a relatable sporting context, in a game of sport, if you're not, again, can use football, hopefully the most universal, understandable sport. If we think of football, if you're just being a training cone out on the field, you're not doing anything for your team. But if you're trying to win the ball, trying to actually, you know, progress your team towards that goal, then you will make mistakes, but it's about the second efforts. Not about not making mistakes, it's about second efforts. And if we consider Christ's example of resilience, because Christ was also resilient, we think of times where he faced constant rejection and questioning. Every place he went to, every group of people he talked to, he often was rejected by, you know, one or all of the people. But that didn't stop him from going and trying to reach out to people and trying to increase the strength of this team that he was building. In a day-to-day context, he knew that Judas would betray him, but he didn't give up on that. He was resilient, continued to try and work with him and to train him to be good. And ultimately, every day he also knew that he was going to die for these people. We think of the time he's talking to God and he's praying, if this cup can be taken from me. And again, that was a choice. He had a choice to just walk away from it, to think, no, this is too hard. But instead, resilient, stuck to his calling. And this is another amazing thing about having a family or an ecclesia or a team, however you want to think about it. is that we have each other to help us bounce back. We can lean on each other for comfort. We can bear each other's burdens, as Paul says in Galatians 6, verse 2, which we read earlier. Now, the final trait or key part of being a spiritual athlete is knowing your position. Now, first things first, I want to stress very clearly that when I say knowing your position, this is not defined by who you are, but it's rather about where your strengths lie. In a sporting context, you aren't chosen in a team because of, you know, what kind of, person you physically are, for example. It's more about how you understand the sport, how you play the sport, where it suits you best. Where does your strength lie? And any good coach won't put someone who's not a good fit in a position that they don't fit into. 1 Peter 4 verse 10 on the screen there speaks of this concept where it says, each of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve others as faithful stewards of God's grace in its various forms. So in a team concept, it's we each have been given a gift. It's not each of you if you've been given a gift. It's whatever gift you have received. We each have something which we are specifically good at that we can harness. And in, a team sport understanding, a lot of team sports have structure, they have processes that they stick to as a team. And if you don't know your position and know exactly what you need to do to better the team, then the team will not function to its optimal capacity. You think of the old saying of there's no I in team, or a champion team is better than a team of champions. And it's that exact concept that we each do have something that we are good at, and we each have a position in this team, and that's where we should sink our time and effort into doing that specific thing really well. And if we think about the analogy of the spiritual body, this really, explains this. I won't read through it because it's quite a long section, but it's in 1 Corinthians 12 if you're interested. And it's, again, the idea that the body cannot function as, a million eyes. We each, the body functions best when every one of its members is doing its own specific job. And so as our character study for this, we will look into Priscilla and Aquila and Co. I forgot to add on the end. Priscilla and Aquila as these central people and some other people around them. And we know that first up, we're going to talk, about Paul and what he was good at. And because he's fairly important to the story. And in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 7, we see that Paul says, of this gospel I was made a minister according to the gift of God's grace, which was given me by the working of his power. So he, identifies very much early on his position as a minister. And when I think of minister, I think of someone who is, out there actively trying to progress, trying to meet people, talk to people. There are ministers behind the scenes, which we'll talk about, but I think Paul identifies himself as someone who, where he needed to sink his energy into was preaching, getting out and seeing people, or to be the front man, if you like. And if we turn over to Acts chapter 18, we are introduced to Priscilla and Aquila. Thanks for the second glass of water, Ben. I made it through the first already. So in Acts chapter 18, we see in verse 1, that Paul leaves Athens, goes to Corinth, and in Corinth he found a Jew named Aquila and his wife Priscilla. And in verse 3, because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and he worked, for they were tent makers by trade. And so this is, I guess, where he sits, his home base with Priscilla and Aquila. And throughout that time, in verse 4, he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath. He's out there trying to persuade Jews and Gentiles. And they stay in, so Paul stays with them in Corinth for 18 months, so a year and a half. And in verse 18, we see that they all leave together. After this, Paul stayed many days longer, then took leave of the brothers and set sail for Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila. So they all set sail and they all end up in Ephesus. And we see another key character in this story introduced in verse 24 of Acts 18. We read there, "Now a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was an eloquent man, competent in the scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he spoke and taught accurately the things concerning Jesus, though he knew only the baptism of John." So we see Apollos's strength immediately identified. He was an eloquent man. He was competent in the scriptures, and he spoke and taught. In verse 26, he began to speak boldly in the synagogue. But when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. And then in verse 27 and 28, we see some of the results of Priscilla and Aquila's action here. And verse 26 is really the key of this idea of knowing your position. We see clearly that Priscilla and Aquila are happy to support Paul in his teaching. They're not trying to, I guess, compete with him. They are presumably, this is all sort of implied, but supporting him behind the scenes. So housing him, providing him no doubt moral and spiritual support if he was living with them for 18 months. And then also this example of Apollos. If Priscilla and Aquila didn't acknowledge that their position lay, that their strengths lay in, I guess, moral support, supporting the ecclesia from more behind the scenes, this section of Acts 18 might have looked a lot different, where I guess they could have conflicted and gone, well, no, we understand it this way, and, you know, butting heads with people in public. Instead, they understood that their position was to take Apollos aside and to provide him, I guess, behind the scenes moral support. And we see some of the great results again. A lot of these are implied of Priscilla and Aquila's support and coaching or mentoring throughout the early ecclesias. In Romans chapter 16, verse 3, Paul acknowledges them in supporting his efforts. And in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 19, Paul implies and thanks them for all the effort they did with him in Corinth. And again, that's a bit of an implication, but that they sort of founded or hosted the Corinthian ecclesia. It says that thank you for, you know, hosting this ecclesia pretty much. So together, these three groups, Priscilla and Aquila, Paul, Apollos, they don't try and, you know, cut each other off or try and fight with each other's roles, try and get to try and work in ways that they don't really suit. Instead, they form a cohesive and effective preaching community. And another example that I guess we could think of knowing your position, we won't go into detail, is John the Baptist, where he, you know, he fulfilled his role. When Jesus came alone, he receded so Jesus could, I can't remember the exact word, increase. Thank you. He decreased so that Jesus could increase. So, why is it important that we know our position? And again, we think of the spiritual body in 1 Peter 4, verse 10, that we all do have a function that we are really good at. and that the body cannot function effectively or optimally without every single person or organ doing its role. No one in our ecclesial body is without a role, and every single role is as important as each other's. There is no hierarchy of importance in roles. We each have one that we're really good at, and they are equally important. Just because Priscilla and Aquila weren't in the limelight does not mean that they were not a critical part of the spiritual body. Just because they weren't the ones out the front, for example, actually doing the preaching. Again, these are all implications, but hopefully you're seeing the picture. That it's not about them getting them preaching themselves, but it's through their support that the body as a whole could grow. And in a team sport context, I think something which really speaks to me, coming from lots of sport, is the idea of off-ball work, and that might mean absolutely nothing to everyone. Ruby thought I should draw a picture for this, but I don't think I will. Sorry, I'm not very good at drawing. But if we think of in a game of football again, I'll draw a picture. I'm really thinking about it here. All right, I'll try and make this as quick and painless as possible. All right, forward 50. Now, we have an attacker here who's trying to get the ball and a defender here. Oh, actually, let's say a defender here. And we have another attacker here. The ball's here. Are we all following? I'm sorry, this might be very confusing. I'll try and make this look like a football. Very bad. Now, what you might think is that the most important person in this context, we're trying to get the ball here, right? The most important person is this person and this person. Well, if you thought that, you're wrong. What is most important is this idea of off-ball work. And this is the stuff that doesn't actually get recognized. What should happen in this scenario is attacker number one should run this way. They shouldn't try and get the ball. Instead, they would take this person away from where we're trying to get the ball to. We following. Cool. Do we see that, on face value, if you're not analyzing it like this, you might think, oh, amazing job by this person here who got the ball. You're the best. What off-ball work is about is working for your teammates, acknowledging that I want him to get the ball because that's what's best for the team. It's not what's best for me. I won't get any credit. But we will get the ball here, which will get us to our goal quicker or more effectively. Off-ball work. And I think that relates really well to, I guess, a spiritual context of it's not about acknowledgement. It's not about, doing it because other people are seeing it or other people are saying, great job. Hopefully that all happens, but that's not the purpose. The purpose is functioning in your position, doing whatever it takes, if that be on ball, off ball. Everything is as important as each other to function at optimal team, functionality. Poor choice of words, but I hope we get what I'm saying. Every single person in that scenario did their role, and that's why they got to the goal. And I think one of the really important things here in our ecclesial or our team context is acknowledging everything, looking for the people who might be working behind the scenes and supporting them, making them feel loved and making them feel like they are part of the team. That is an essential part of being a spiritual athlete, not just doing the work, but also acknowledging it and building each other up. Sports lesson over. Got plenty more where they came from if you're interested. So hopefully our journey through becoming a better spiritual athlete as a team and playing on God's team has taught you something about how we can function better as an ecclesia as we run towards our goal that we again saw in Revelation 7. And just a quick recap or our take homes, if you like, what we looked at was specifically our discipline, And key things there are being what we take in, staying separate, being disciplined in what we ingest, training, having repetition or consistency in how we train ourselves, and how we also are consistently meeting together and trying to better each other. And then taking time for reflection and feedback, leaning on other people who might be able to see things differently to you and see how you might be able to improve or how you're doing really well. So that reflection and feedback and accountability applies to both sides, giving the feedback and receiving. Resilience. Remember that you will make mistakes. That's not an if, that is a will, but it's about what you do next. It's the second efforts. It's about bouncing back, remembering that you are forgiven, that sin will not hold you back, but instead God wants you to be in that Revelation 7 picture. He wants you there. So remember that, bounce back and keep taking action. Don't let mistakes, smother you. Finally, knowing your position. Find what you're good at. Apply yourself in that position. Always acknowledge everyone's role, whether that be on the ball or off the ball. And as we close, we remember that Hyde Park is not, I actually don't know how many members you have, but however many members you have, you're not all individuals on an individual path to a prize that you will receive individually. Rather, you are individuals that are part of a worldwide team, a team that dates back thousands of years, and that together you are striving for the goal we saw in Revelation 7, to be in that kingdom, but also to give praise and honour to God in the best way we possibly can, to spread awareness of the great hope we have, knowing that together we can do that more effectively than we could as individuals. And just like a successful sports team, we will train together, we'll win together, we'll lose together throughout our season. However, ultimately, we can have confidence that if we do work together effectively, if we do support one another through the ups, the downs, which the season might bring, we will make it to the end, and together we will win that prize. Together we will celebrate the greatest victory of all time. Thanks.